Before we get going, the last four numbers of your phone, 0838, if you'll announce yourself. Otherwise, we will send you out of this meeting. And then the next phone number, we need to have you identify yourself. Last four digits of your phone number, 7173. If you can identify yourself.
They left.
Okay.
And then Bill Hardy is on, so I'll send him off.
And it's still there.
So, remove the meeting. Nicholas Herman. Okay, so
excellent.
Now we should be. Come on. That's Kathy. Yep, we're good.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thank you, staff. We will start off with case number 80 in your meeting book of Kathleen Shin, board member, Oregon State Board of Nursing. If we can start off with a staff report, please.
And I notified, so we're waiting for them to request to be added.
Oh, okay.
But she's been notified?
Yes.
Okay. Is she the spokesperson?
She's the president of the Board of
Okay,
Nursing.
So the others didn't want to be here?
Yes.
Okay.
They kind of presented a group response anyway, but... Yeah.
Okay.
Do we want to wait, give her a few minutes, or just proceed?
She has to be in here, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think we can proceed.
Okay. I just sent an alarm, so...
Okay. Chair Mason, commissioners, items 78 to 86 of preliminary review reports for the 9 members of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. The current board president, Kathleen Shin, was the one who wanted to attend. These cases involved 2 executive sessions on September 9th and November 18th, 2020, at which the nursing board considered a disciplinary case involving our complainant. The complainant raised a number of issues with the nursing board's consideration of her case, most of which are not within our jurisdiction. The 2 issues that are within our jurisdiction are, first, whether the board properly convened its executive session, and second, whether the board voted while in executive session. On the first issue, it appears that the notices for the board's executive sessions cited ORS 192.660, but did not cite to subsection 2L, which is the appropriate provision for an executive session to discuss disciplinary matters for health regulatory bodies. The script that the board president reads before moving into executive session does, however, identify the reason for convening these executive sessions, which in this case was to consider information obtained as part of an investigation of licensees or applicant conduct. This language is taken from subsection 2L. Because the board did announce the language, the substantive language of the provision, even though they did not identify subsection 2L, it appears that they may have substantially complied with the requirements of 192.660.1. During the preliminary review, they also changed their notices to include a citation to the subsection. On the second issue, the board's response explains that their practice is to group categories of cases together, hear them in executive session, go back into public session to vote on each case individually, then go into a new executive session to consider the next category of cases. They have very long meetings. These are 3-day meetings. So during the day, the board moves into and out of executive session several times. This practice raises the question of whether the board satisfies the requirements of subsection 660 subsection 1 each time? Do they always re-announce and give the proper notice of what they'll be discussing? But it also, there's nothing in the minutes, however, to indicate that they do so. Additionally, the minutes that we saw from the November 18th executive session where they voted on the complainant's case, the minutes do not reflect that they ever moved back into public session. The minutes make it appear that they're voting while in executive session. We are recommending that the commission move this matter to investigation so that we can actually confirm what actually takes place in these sessions. Do they move out before they vote? And are they properly announcing each time they move back in?
Okay. Thank you. Do we have any questions for staff from our commissioners at this point? Because I don't believe we have anybody representing the other side. Commissioner O'Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Myers. Nice report. I think it's probably obvious, but just want to state out there for the record, we take votes in executive session because we have special statutory ability to do so.
Correct.
Does this particular board enjoy the same statutory privilege?
It does not. There is an existing AG opinion, and they are subject to all sorts of sort of additional requirements about maintaining the confidentiality of the people they're investigating, so that they don't use their names in the minutes and so forth until they impose discipline. But that AG opinion and the AG manual all specify, yes, they have to come out of executive session to vote.
Thank you. And Commissioner O'Day, that's just one of the many reasons we'll miss you when you are gone for bringing that expertise to the table. Any other, okay, Commissioner Hollister. Oh, you're on mute.
So proud of myself for getting my hand raised and I can't get off mute. just a quick question for staff on the sort of reach of our jurisdictional reach. Obviously, we don't have jurisdiction over the requirements for executive session minutes. And so what's awkward about this situation where the minutes might be a little wonky and it doesn't, I mean, could you talk to me about how we have jurisdiction over the lack of clarity in the minutes in this case? I just was struggling with that.
Right. We definitely do not have any jurisdiction over their minutes. My problem is I suspect in this case that the minutes may not actually reflect what took place. And so the only jurisdiction here is for me to get the recording so I can see or hear whether they actually did move out of executive session and move into public session for the vote and then move back in. And in the 30 days that we had for PR, there was simply no way to do that.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Any other questions from commissioners? Seeing none, and obviously we're not going to wait for the other individual. So
is she on yet? Is Ms. Chin on yet?
No.
I can't. Decipher all that Monica would know.
Yeah, no, not on yet.
Seeing that, if we can get a motion.
Mr. Chair, hearing no comments, further comments from commissioners or the subject of the complaint, I will move that the commission accept the staff recommendation to move to a full investigation of matters involving Ms. Kathleen Chin from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, a roll call vote.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We'll move up to 78 and since this group of 78 through
83.
I think she's just joining. They're
chatting. If you look, yeah, right there. I'm participants, so. But it's got a one button, which indicates. Oh, there's somebody waiting in the lobby.
Oh, no, Mark Wolf. That's the next case. Yes, okay, I sent her.
Okay.
Thank you, sorry.
We will continue with. number 78, Cheryl Oakes, Caddy.
Yeah, Chair Mason, Commissioners, this report is the same as the one previously presented.
Thank you. Any discussion on or a question for staff? Seeing none, we can have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the Commission accept the staff recommendation to conduct a full investigation of matters involving Ms. Cheryl Oakes Caddy from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll move with a roll call vote in just a moment.
Oh, we went to 78, sorry.
Yeah, no worries. I'm almost getting dizzy going.
Sorry, guys.
No worries.
All right, Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Set both of the next turn.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Item number 79, Michelle Chu, board member, Oregon State Board of Nursing. Can we get a, obviously.
Chair Mason, the report is the same for
Michelle. Yep, same report. If we can get a roll, or I'm sorry, if we can get a motion to move forward.
Mr. Chair, I will move that we accept the staff recommendation to investigate possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Ms. Michelle Chow from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we can have a roll call vote.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay, item number 81, Annette Cole.
Chair Mason, the only difference in this report is that Ms. Cole was not present on the November 18th meeting, was present on the September 9th meeting.
Okay. Thank you for that. Any questions for staff? Seeing none, if we can get a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we approve the staff recommendation to conduct a full investigation of possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Ms. Annette Cole from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Any discussion on the motion? And a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. On number 82, Adrian. Enghouse.
Chair Mason, Commissioners, again, this is similar, but she was not present at the second meeting. She was present at the first.
Okay. Thank you for that. Any questions for staff? We can have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move we accept the staff recommendation to conduct an investigation of possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Ms. Adrienne Enghouse from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. If we can have a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Item number 83, Aaron Green.
Chair Mason, Commissioners, Mr. Green was not on the board for the first of the meeting, joined the board in time for the second of the meeting.
Okay, thank you for that. If we can have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we approve the staff recommendation to conduct an investigation of possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Mr. Aaron Green from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Item number 84, Barbara Turnipseed?
Turnipseed. Chair Mason, Barbara Turnipseed was present at both meetings. Her report is the same as the original.
Thank you for that. Any questions for the staff? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we approve the staff recommendation to conduct to investigate the possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Ms. Barbara Turnipseed from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Item number 85, Judy Woodruff. Can't talk to
her. Chair Mason, Mr. Woodruff was present at both meetings and the report is the same.
Thank you. And a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we accept the staff recommendation to conduct an investigation of possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Ms. Judith Woodruff from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Final one in this group, number 86, Michael Winter Lightfoot.
Chair Mason, Commissioners, Mr. Winter Lightfoot was present at both meetings and his report is the same as the original.
Thank you. And a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we accept the staff recommendation to investigate possible violations of ORS 192.660 involving Mr. Michael Winter Lightfoot from the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. Any discussion? Seeing none, a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay, so we will move to number 87. I believe the
they're both here. The respondent and the attorney.
Mr. Wolf.
Go ahead and let them in now.
Yep. All right, this is time for a staff report.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Mason and Commissioners. My name is Lisa Kristen. For the record, I'm an investigator with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Before you is the matter of Karen Labonte, case number 21-068-ELC, page 391 and item 87 in your meeting book. Ms. Labonte is the Public Works Director of the City of Cannon Beach. The complaint filed by a citizen of Cannon Beach alleged that respondent might have attempted to use her position to obtain financial gain for herself or failed to declare a conflict of interest when she disposed of city-owned surplus property. Ms. Labonte, as Public Works Director, was in charge of disposing of a collection of wooden fence posts on the surplus property of the city. Ms. Labonte made an effort to give the posts to a nonprofit and then notified several area contractors and handymen that the posts were available to whomever wanted them. The contractor who performed work on Ms. Labonte's home eventually took the fence posts. Per review performed by Bruce St. Denis, the city manager of Cannon Beach, Ms. Labonte followed the procedure set forth in the city's municipal code for disposing of surplus city property. Further investigation was needed to determine whether Ms. Labonte received any financial benefit from her contractor by tendering the fence post from the city to her contractor. Commission staff, however, received input from Ms. Labonte's attorney and her contractor after the preliminary review report had been filed. And the same is in your meeting book attached to the preliminary review report, which addresses those issues. Ms. Labonte may have failed to properly declare a conflict of interest. ORS 244-121C requires an appointed official such as responded to notify their supervisor in writing about any actual or potential conflict, and also to request the supervisor dispose of the conflict. That preliminary review report is in your meeting book with a recommendation to move the matter to investigation. Thank you.
Thank you for that report. And we have Ms. Labonte on with her attorney.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of our investigator first?
Absolutely.
Just a brief question. Thank you, Ms. Kristen, for this report. I appreciate it. Could you repeat for me the summary of what the focus would be of further investigation? And I can't remember where I saw that in here, so thank you for summarizing that.
Certainly. Two points. One is that we did receive information after my preliminary review report was tendered from Mr. Wolf, and Mr. Wolf had appended to that, which is also in the meeting book, a response from Cliff Lewis, who is the contractor at issue here, that apparently took the fence post. There is a response in there indicating, as you can see, that he stated that there was no financial benefit. He did knock, you know, any off the price of her house for getting these fence posts. But I would like an opportunity to speak with him myself. The second point is the conflict of interest. Again, if we're looking at this as a conflict of interest case, and she is an employee of the city, what she needed to do was put in writing and ask for her supervisor to somehow handle the conflict. That may have happened, and I can talk to Mr. St. Denis, but again, in the period of time, I didn't receive that information. So that's what the need for investigation would be at this point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
I just have a question for you. But you have to figure out if there's actually a conflict of interest.
Correct.
Because, you know, she is not, this is not a business with which she's associated, this contractor, correct?
Correct. It was the contractor was working on her home, so the conflict would be that she personally may have received some benefit from her action as a city official. And that needs to be explored by giving him the fence post if there was any benefit to her. But you're absolutely right, Ron, that what needs to be looked at is, again, initially, is there a conflict? And if so, was it handled in the way the statute prescribes?
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Labonte and your attorney, this would be the opportunity for you to present to the commission.
Yes, thank you. My name is Mark Wolf. I'll be speaking on behalf of Ms. Labonte here. So I guess to provide a little context as to why we're here, I believe we're here because this is a personal grudge between Mr. Morris and my client. These two have known each other for over 10 years. It started out, they were on friendly terms. You know, if we note that this public works cleanup and the disposal of this surplus property was in 2018, 3 years ago. However, the relationship between the complainant and my client made a turn for the worse in spring of 2020 when COVID hit, and the complainant would contact my client demanding that she shut down the city, keep tourists away, things that as public works director, she has no authority. Things began to get worse during the presidential election. There were so many phone calls, so many text messages that my client had to, you know, block the complainant's phone number, had to block him from social media in an attempt to distance herself from him and to avoid him and hope that things would go away. That worked for a while until February of this year when he made his first complaint to this commission. Further, continuing in February of this year, my client's neighbors spot the complainant parked in her driveway, out of his car, taking pictures of her house. My client and her husband have seen this gentleman drive by her house upwards of, or minimum of 40 times, is what my client's estimation is. He's contacting the news media, KGW News. He's contacting the local Astorian newspaper. He's contacting the city auditor, demanding that the city auditor open an investigation. And I believe that he's even demanded from the investigator herself that that the investigator somehow remove my client from office. So this is a personal grudge. This is why this is his attempt to further this animosity or this grudge that he holds towards my client. So that's why we're here. I wanted to provide some context on that. As to the facts, you know, this was, again, in 2018. This was a planned cleanup of the public works facilities. There was a bunch of junk that was found that was thrown away. There was some other metal posts that Karen was able to return to the vendor. And then there were these wooden fence posts that had been laying around for a number of years on the coast, subject to the wind, the rain, you know, the salt in the air that made these posts, you know, essentially of no value. So my client goes and talks with the finance director, the city manager, who authorized her to dispose of this property by just giving it away. So the city deems that these posts have no value. My client contacts two state parks in the area, thinking that they might come and haul them away. These state parks don't want them. There's no value to the state parks. So they offer these posts up to a few contractors in the area that they know of. On a first-come, first-served basis, you know, this is akin to putting these posts on the side of the road with a free sign. Anybody that wants to come get them can come get them. As Cliff Lewis confirms, you know, my client never asked for, never hinted at, never insinuated that she wants, you know, the cost of her house to be somehow lower due to these fence posts being offered up. The posts were never used on her house. She simply offered these posts up in consultation with city staff to whoever might come haul them away rather than just throwing them in the dumpster. And so I think it's clear that there is no but-for violation under 244-040 with Cliff Lewis's statement or email confirmation that Karen never asked for, hinted at, insinuated any, you know, quid pro quo for these. And there is no conflict of interest. Again, this is Karen following city code, working with her boss, the city manager, who's authorized her to get rid of this stuff. They offer it up to whoever wants it on a first-come, first-served basis. These are posts that the city doesn't want. The city wants to get rid of them. State parks don't want them. And further, even Cliff Lewis, I spoke to him on the phone, he even just gave them away after taking them from the city. So these posts have no value, and we ask that you dismiss this complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Commissioner Hollister, you've had your hand up for a while. I'm assuming that was to for our investigator initially.
That's correct, Chair. I just was curious to hear our investigator's response to Mr. Wolf's letter, if she wouldn't mind sharing that.
I'm sorry, my response to
Mr. Wolf's letter.
Mr. Wolf's letter.
Oh, okay.
I think you said that came in after you submitted your report, and so I just was curious to hear how that, if and how that changed your evaluation of the matter.
Well, the tricky thing for me is that after 30 days has run, I cannot work on my preliminary review report again. That's why I attached the letter and the email, and I did read it and review it, and I guess just as I reiterated, the only thing I guess I would do is probably contact Mr. Lewis directly, because I have an email from him, and I have no reason to doubt that that's accurate and correct, just to make sure that I have a chance to speak with him and find out. For example, I didn't know that the post had been subsequently given away. That's a fact that, you know, again, had I known that within 30 days, would have been helpful and possibly dispositive in my report. I can echo what Mr. Wolf is saying, that I have heard from this complainant many times, and from my position, it does appear that there's some, this is a man who called me and asked me if I could have her removed from her position. I got two emails from him this morning already, so there is a context here of someone who is repeatedly contacting our office and other people and having them contact me about Ms. Levante. So that is some context that I'm glad Mr. Wolf brought up that does surround this. As far as the letter from Mr. Wolf, again, he and I have discussed this case, and the only thing I can offer is as to the but-for, we need to talk to Mr. Lewis himself, simply because I did not have the opportunity to do that. I didn't hear from him until after the 30 days had run.
Thank you for that.
Okay, wonderful. So it sounds like the additional information provided would not have changed your recommended action. Is that correct?
It's hard to answer that. I mean, I can only speculate that maybe I wouldn't have asked to proceed on a but-for, but again, without an opportunity to speak to Mr. Lewis, I can't say with certainty.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you,
Commissioner Hollister. Executive Director Burson.
So just to answer Commissioner Hollister's question, for myself, my signature on this, I think Investigator Kristen might have had a hard time convincing me if we could have worked on with the information that we have now. But you have to remember, we're precluded from actually looking at that information and considering it after the 30 days, or actually after my signature on the complaint. But I will tell you, if we had that information beforehand, even without contact from Mr. Lewis, because like I said, we have no reason to believe that Mr. Lewis is not being forthright in this, my recommendation might have been different coming to you. So,
thank you, Director Burson. And then Commissioner O'Day.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have any questions, more of a comment, given what we've heard thus far. I guess I'm not in distress. I should put my name up, right? Maybe I'm in distress. I just don't know it. So, this is one of those difficult things where a preliminary review period is so short that it doesn't allow our staff sufficient time to fully develop the record. And ordinarily, when we get this sort of information in our preliminary review executive sessions, because I'm convinced, with what we have in front of us, that there's not a violation here and the case is worthy of being dismissed. However, that being said, I think validating a few facts and having the decision happen in an open meeting on the record might go well for the respondent here, given the personal nature of the complainant. I certainly wouldn't want there to be an allegation that we didn't fully investigate this case and fully dispose of it as a result. And so, I for one would be willing to vote in favor of continuing adopting staff recommendation, knowing that if validated, that would result in a dismissal of this particular complaint.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Commissioner Fiscom.
I want to associate myself with the comments from my fellow commissioners Hollister and O'Day. If we had the 60-day preliminary review, we could have resolved this issue, to state what's obvious relative to what will be effective in January as opposed to now. That's observation one, state the obvious. Observation two is I always have this hesitancy to want to get involved in, Mr. Wolf has called it a personal grudge, I will say a local political issue for want of a better label. I always have some hesitancy on in that regard. At the same time, the third thing is I think Commissioner O'Day is probably right in that our staff couldn't go beyond Mr. Burson's signature even to consider new information, and that may underline the fact that our obligation should be to move to an investigation, as long as I add something I often add, which is that such action, if we take it in a few minutes, does not constitute our agreement that there has actually been a violation. We would be conducting an investigation to determine if there was a violation, and I think that those words are really important in the public understanding of if the public is involved at all or cares at all, if the public understands what it means when we decide to conduct an investigation. That can create the misapprehension that we believe there has been a violation and we're investigating it. We don't know whether there has been. That's why we investigate. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiscom. Commissioner Edwards has had her hand up for a moment. We'll go to Commissioner Edwards.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the comments from both Commissioner Fiscom and Commissioner O'Day. And Commissioner O'Day, really, I will sorely miss you when you do leave the commission at the end of this meeting. I very much follow in alignment with the line of thinking that Commissioner O'Day presented. However, I reach a different conclusion just based on the fact I would support a dismissal for this case because I feel that Ms. Labonte is asking for what she believes would be most helpful for herself, and having legal counsel here if it would help support for me the idea that what she believes would be most helpful to her in resolving this kind of existential issue is actually a dismissal. So and my reasoning, using the same line of logic of Commissioner O'Day, I would reach the conclusion that actually supporting a dismissal in this case would be more effective.
Thank you, Commissioner Edwards. We're going to go to Commissioner Hollister, then Commissioner Lindsay.
Thank you, Chair. I find myself, again, persuaded by the reasoning of my co-commissioners, and I just wanted to state that, you know, I think in these situations where there is sort of a significant context of animus, between the complainant and the public official, I think our role is that much more crucial. In this instance, our staff is, you know, as they've expressed, is boxed in by the current statutory requirements, and so they cannot consider information that is submitted after a certain date and time. I don't see anything in the Act that prohibits the Commission from doing so, however. So I think it's our obligation and our duty as commissioners to consider all of the evidence before us. And, you know, as staff has informed us, the standard is a preponderance of the evidence. And, you know, based on the record before me now, I simply don't see proof of any sort of a violation by even that low standard. I don't see any evidence other than complainant's sort of, allegation, which is not based on any sort of personal knowledge, to support the existence of either violation. And so, I think I would end up, my preference would be to vote for dismissal at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hollister. Commissioner Lindsay.
I really appreciate what Commissioner Edwards and Commissioner Hollister said and completely agree with them. I appreciate the argument to take care of the process and the procedure, but I think our primary responsibility is to what the complainant brings, and I would not like to participate in prolonging this experience for her, and so I would be supporting the motion to dismiss as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay. Commissioner Fiscom.
Mr. Chair, I have sympathy for the comments of Commissioners Hollister, Edwards, and Lindsay. I have a question for Mr. Burson or potentially for our legal counsel if he or she is on today, which is that if the staff is prevented from considering information beyond 30 days, is the commission also by statute prevented from considering information beyond 30 days?
No.
I assumed the answer was no, but I wanted to make sure that was stated for the record because I don't think we have the same we operate under the same prohibition as staff does with regard to 30 days.
No, right. there's no prohibition for you folks to consider, just like there's no prohibition for the respondent to supply additional information. And the complaint can actually supply additional information. You've seen that both times, and we usually provide that to you either in the book or if we get it between the time the book is sent out and the meeting date, we'll supply you with that here or in an email. So
thank you.
Commissioner O'Day.
Thank you. I do appreciate the viewpoints that have been expressed, and ordinarily have kind of lent that way in these preliminary review hearings where there's evidence brought forward that there wasn't a violation. What's different here for me, though, is that as we do owe the respondent an obligation, we also owe the complainant and the public an obligation to fully investigate these complaints that are made. And we heard our investigators say that the evidence that has come in would certainly suggest there's not a violation, but there'd be a few more interviews to be had to confirm that. And that's the reason why I think we should move forward, which is to specifically investigate those additional matters, substantiate those facts so we can close this case out.
I will say, seeing no other commissioners with their hands up, I think me and Commissioner Starr are the only ones that haven't spoken on this. This is probably one of the few ones that I've been very torn on. You, Commissioner O'Day, put puts forth a very persuasive argument to move forward with investigating, and that that could actually benefit Mr. Wolf's client. But at the same time, I'm in total agreement with Commissioner Edwards that not to say that we would be rewarding a complaint with moving forward, but based on that behavior, that's definitely suspect. It's questionable with regards to what we have in front of us, whether there's a true violation. And so, I would be leaning towards dismissal. And so I would be interested to seeing, our final commissioner who hasn't spoken on this matter, where he's leaning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very persuaded to dismiss this because there's no reason to involve staff in the further review of something that's been confirmed by the evidence that we have seen. So the staff would not have a lot of time involved, but there would be some staff time involved. There would be time involved for the commissioners at a future date. I say we dismiss this complaint.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Starr. Do we have
a
motion?
Such a motion.
And the motion is to dismiss by Commissioner Starr. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Starr.
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards.
Aye.
Commissioner Fiscom.
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister.
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day.
Nay.
Commissioner Mason.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. We appreciate you being with us today, and our staff will be in touch.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. We will move on. We will stay in executive session.
We need to have a bio break soon.
Oh, yeah. Do we need to take one?
I don't care. You're the chair.
Let's go with...
I'm waiting for this one to respond, 77. So
77?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you wanted to go the...
Okay. We'll just keep moving through the executive session schedule from where we're at. So case number 88, Stacy Bartholomew, City Council, City of Hood River.
Thank you. Those slightly out of order, I apologize.
No worries.
Chair Mason and Commission, again, for the record, it's Lisa Kristen. I'm an investigator with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Before you is a matter of Stacy Bartholomew, case number 21-074 ELC. It's at page 407, item 88 in your meeting book. Stacy Bartholomew is a member of the Albany City Council and was so during the period of time relevant to this preliminary review.
I'm sorry, is it Albany?
I think the agenda is in error.
Okay.
The report says Albany. The agenda says Hood River.
Okay.
Hey, how did you do that?
Well, I apologize. I didn't see that in the agenda, but the report does indicate that the city of Albany.
Thank you.
It is relevant to the review that Ms. Bartholomew became a counselor in January of 2021 as she took over an unexpired term of another counselor. Complainant alleged that Stacy Bartholomew might have attempted to use her position to obtain financial gain for an employer or may have failed to declare a conflict of interest when a proposal regarding the sale of city-owned land was acted upon by the Albany City Council. Specifically, complainant alleges that respondent has a conflict of interest in that a business with which she is associated has a financial interest in a property placed for sale by the council. Ms. Bartholomew is an unpaid volunteer director of a nonprofit, Creating Housing Coalition, which is an agency that creates housing opportunities to homeless people in the Albany area. The complaint of action of Ms. Bartholomew was the discussion and vote at the April 14, 2021 Albany City Council meeting in which the council members discussed the implementation of the City of Albany Master Parks Plan, which had been finalized in February 2021. This was a plan that had been put in place to address how to revitalize, revamp, and dispose of excess property devised by the City of Albany. It was a work in which they had contacted everyone involved, every shareholder, if you will, citizens of Albany, and people in the community, as well as employees of the city, to determine what the best path forward was for the City of Albany Parks. It had been in place for some time, was finalized in written form, and presented to the community as a whole in February of 2021. One of the recommendations of the plan was the divestment of two City Park properties, Hazelwood Park and North Point property. At the April 14, 2021 meeting, the council voted, after public input and discussion, to declare the properties as surplus property to free them
unknown
up.
Unknown participant is now joining.
It's a member of the media.
Okay. Council voted to declare the properties surplus, which would be the first step in freeing them up for sale. A possible sale is the next step. No specific proposed buyer or any other interested party was identified at that meeting regarding either Hazelwood Park or the North Point property. Although Ms. is alleged to have had a conflict of interest, respondent's only association with CHC, a nonprofit tax-exempt entity, is as a director. As such, CHC is explicitly excluded from the definition of business. This is not a business with which she'd be associated. Moreover, in the case before the commission, there's no apparent attempt to obtain financial gain for respondent or any business with which she's associated in any event from the actions taken by respondent. As outlined above, the only decision made regarding Hazelwood Park at that time was to declare the same as surplus in accordance with the Albany Master Plan. Also, as noted above, CHC, had it been an issue at the meeting, is not a business with which respondent would be associated. There was no mention of any specific buyers. Again, the minutes of the meeting reflect that what was discussed was simply whether or not it was appropriate at that time, again, after public input and in accordance with the Master Plan, to divest the properties and declare them surplus so that they could move forward with the plan to do something with these properties. But I think it's important to note that at that time they hadn't even decided whether or not they were actually going to sell the properties. CHC, the business at issue here that was alleged in the complaint, was not mentioned at all at this meeting, or at any meeting that I could find. As such, no financial gain was obtained or attempted to be gained by respondent or any business associated with respondent by any use of official position of respondent regarding council's action. And again, I wrote in relation to Hazelwood Park, but it's important to note that CHC was not mentioned. What was mentioned was simply the park, that and another parcel of property. For all of those reasons, the preliminary review report is in your meeting book with a recommendation that this complaint be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you for that report. Any questions for the investigator from commissioners? Commissioner Hollister.
No question. Just wanted to compliment staff on the thorough job in this case. I really appreciated it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discuss or questions for staff? Seeing none, we take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I will move to accept the staff recommendation to dismiss complaint or complaints against Ms. Stacy Bartholomew, City Councilor from the City of Albany.
Thank you, Commissioner Fitzcomb. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fitzcomb?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our case number 89 of John Weddle, Lane County School District.
So I have a message in for them to attend. They have not responded yet.
Okay.
And that would be case 89 through 93 that they're representing.
There is an attorney, Ms. Nancy Hummerford, who would like to appear as well on that case. So.
That is the one that was notified, and we're waiting.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Interestingly enough, the number that was given was a landline. So it says to...
Does it still exist?
Yeah.
I have one.
But yeah. I've been able to text, so I'm waiting to hear back.
Does the person who wants to appear... virtually relate to any of the particular items or all of them?
This is the attorney for all of the cases.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you want to go back and get number 77.
Yeah, I was going to say.
77 is also not responding. I've texted.
Was that
there's an attorney as well.
There's an attorney, Christina.
Okay. So, Not to keep skipping around, because I don't like having the staff get jump all over out of order, but in an effort to accommodate both attorneys, I think we'll move to case number 94 in executive session.
I will text right now then.
They were on earlier, so it's okay.
Maybe we start hearing all the ones that don't have attorneys first.
They all do at this point for
with all due respect,
all
attorneys.
Do.
Except for
Taylor also?
96 and 95.
I'm not the only attorney.
They both have attorneys.
You only one present,
though. 96 and 95 does not.
Oh, okay. I mean, sir, we will seriously move to case number 95 based on, you know,
or is thinking out loud inappropriately, true.
So I'll
well,
find out.
Sometimes your thoughts are, you know, correctly directed.
So from
case number
Nick Herman is coming on now, which is case number 94.
Okay. We'll pause.
94? It's a good one.
It's a hard one today. You get your steps in.
Right.
So just to clarify, we are doing 94 for Topaz, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Herman? Come on, Mr. Herman.
He said okay, and should be coming in. Trying to join now. There we are. Very good.
Yeah.
Yay. I'll work on the others.
By the way, he just left. He came in and then he
came
left.
In and then said leaving, yeah.
Okay.
Topaz?
Well, Herman.
Herman.
Oh, Herman. Okay.
Herman for Topaz.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Topaz is in the office with him.
We have to check to make sure that the guest is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the same guy.
Yeah, Mr. Herman.
Very good.
Mr. Herman, welcome.
And Mr. Thomas.
There we go.
Okay. Looks like we're ready for case number 94. Of Stephen Topaz, City Councilor of City of Helens, St. Helens.
Chair Mason, Commissioners. Item 94 is a preliminary review report for Stephen Topaz, who is appearing by video along with his attorney, Nick Herman. The complaint in this case was filed by Matthew Brown, the City Finance Director and Assistant City Administrator. Mr. Brown alleges that Stephen Topaz used his position for personal financial gain during April 2019 budget committee hearings by trying to get the city to add to its capital improvement plan stormwater repairs that would benefit his personal property. The complaint includes a number of allegations that do not fall within the commission's jurisdiction. The one allegation that does, for the one allegation that does, Mr. Brown provided a copy of an executive summary of an investigation into Mr. Topaz that was commissioned by the city's attorney. The executive summary concludes that Stephen Topaz attempted to put his personal residence on a list of city projects during a budget committee meeting in April 2019. During the preliminary review period, I watched the video recording of the two budget committee meetings in April 2019. In the April 15th meeting, Mr. Topaz asked if stormwater collection was going to be included in the capital improvement plan. Stormwater collection and flooding of Mr. Topaz's basement was an issue in a 2010-2012 lawsuit that Mr. Topaz brought against the city prior to becoming a city councilor. While stormwater improvements would benefit Mr. Topaz's residence, at this budget committee meeting, he did not propose anything or demand anything. It appears all he did was ask the question, quote, let's get back to the water, stormwater mess. Some of the places stormwater was not put in when they isolated the sanitary sewer. There are a lot of places that do not have stormwater collection. Is that going to be reinvestigated? Even if he were not a city councilor or a member of the budget committee, he could have posed that question. Public comments and questions are permitted during the budget committee meetings. Based on our review of the video recording, there does not appear to be a violation of 244.040. It is, however, possible that Mr. Topaz may have violated the conflict of interest statutes by failing to disclose a potential conflict of interest. The discussion of stormwater improvements and flooding of his neighborhood, including but not limited to his personal property, could lead to a financial benefit if, in the future, it resulted in those matters being included in the capital improvement plan. It does appear that Mr. Topaz may be a member of a class consisting of property owners in his neighborhood. It is possible that a class exception would apply, but we would need to determine if the potential financial impact of the improvements would apply to all members of the class to the same degree that it would apply to Mr. Topaz. The report that is in your meeting books recommends that this matter go to investigation.
Thank you for that. Questions for Commissioner O'Day?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a gap in my public ethics knowledge. Thank you for identifying the class issue, Ms. Myers, and thank you for identifying the potential conflict. As we know, a class, if one exists, can be a reason for there not to be a conflict. However, when there's a potential conflict of interest, the public official is required to announce the nature of that conflict on the record, but then can participate in the discussion of the vote. With those two points of law in mind, my question is, if a class exists, is the disclosure on the record still required?
If a class exists, the disclosure, that has no impact on the disclosure. If the class exception exists, there is no required disclosure. And that's the distinction here, is that he may be a member of a class, but if not all members of the class are affected to the same degree, then the class exception would not exist. It's a two-prong. You see, am I a member of a class? Am I a property owner in this neighborhood? Yes. But the class exception will only exist for those property owners if they all get the same benefit. They're affected to the same degree.
And if they are, then there's no need to announce the potential conflict.
Correct.
But if there's an inequity in how that benefit is applied to all members of that class, whether I'm going to get a bigger benefit or a lesser benefit, then at that point the conflict exists and the disclosure must be made.
Correct. And you are right that he would only need in such a case to disclose a potential conflict and could still participate and so forth. It was a little awkward because the nature of this discussion in the budget committee meeting, there was no clear indication that, you know, we're about to consider a motion and I should disclose a conflict of interest. It was kind of a free-ranging discussion, and I don't think there was any light bulb going off saying, disclose any conflict now.
And the reason why this is a potential is because it was a vote on the budget, not a vote on actually approving or doing the actual public works project.
Twofold, yes. As a member of the budget committee, it would really only be a potential because all they can do is kind of propose or recommend an action that may not actually take place because the city council would need to approve it. But also that the discussion at hand was not even
95.
Proposed. This stormwater improvement wasn't in the capital improvement plan. There was no proposal to put it in the improvement plan. So it would only be potential because if it got proposed and then if the city council approved it, there might be a financial benefit.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question for Investigator Myers. So I guess where I'm a little bit stuck in the legal analysis, and I'm hoping you can help me out, is this identifying whether or not the issue would affect all class members sort of similarly. It seems like with an issue like stormwater, I mean, water is a common enemy. I mean, it seems like to some extent it would be a subjective analysis. I mean, unless someone was sort of required to, like, have a knowledge of, like, I don't know, how water would flow in a flood. I'm just trying to get my head around, like, how would you, as a public official, come to the conclusion that the class exception applied when there is, to some extent, this sort of subjective element to the analysis?
I don't disagree about the subjectivity. In this case, I mean, based on what I read of the original lawsuit back from 2010, Mr. Topaz's, the city had done this sort of sewer stormwater realignment thing. Mr. Topaz's basement flooded, and that led to a lawsuit. Now, based on the information in that lawsuit, he had some pumps that were pumping out 4,000 to 8,000 gallons of water a day. I mean, sounded like a major mess. He did point out in his interview that he had shown the city administrator one of his neighbors whose property was also flooding. What I don't know is his property the most low-lying property and therefore would be the one most likely to flood and be therefore improved by the by new stormwater drains, or I just don't have that information.
Right, I hear you. And I mean, it seems like it could be a fairly sort of complex issue,
yes.
Because even if you're the most low-lying neighbor, if the source of the intrusion is far away from you, maybe it wouldn't impact you, you know, as
right.
significantly. I mean, as a non-engineer, I'm a little bit flummoxed by the analysis that the public official has to engage in here. And so, I don't know. I guess I'll thank you for your help in muddling through that. I appreciate it.
Any other questions for investigators? Seeing none, Mr. Herman, this would be your opportunity for you and Mr. Topaz to address the commissioners.
Okay, thank you. Can you folks hear me?
Yep, perfect.
Okay, and I'm sorry, my sound system wasn't working at the very beginning, so I was prepared to talk about both issues that were raised. Does anyone want to hear anything on the first issue, or should I just skip to the conflict of interest? Okay, thank you. So the only points that we would make, my understanding for conflict of interest is it's only financial gain. Our position here is that this was just a discussion. There was no motion. There was no overt action to do anything, and that even if there was, I don't see how he would receive any sort of direct financial benefit here. In addition to not receiving any direct financial gain, it wasn't like he was going to sell off his sump pumps or anything if this problem was fixed. So it would basically just be fixing a problem, which applies to a whole neighborhood. With regard to the group class exception, there's about two blocks here and about 12 houses. In Mr. Topaz's professional opinion, and he is an engineer, this is a water issue, and water affects everybody, and downhill is downhill. And so this, there can be an investigation potentially, but it should conclude that everybody was roughly affected equally. There is one distinction in that there's input versus mitigation. And so on the input level, everybody should be roughly affected equally. Some of the property owners maybe don't care. Some have taken actions to mitigate. And so some at the end of the equation might be affected in varying degrees. But in terms of the actual input of the water, everybody should be affected equally. And so we would like to see a group class exception apply to this. The last thing I would say is that our understanding position is that a conflict of interest disclosure wasn't required. Maybe he should have disclosed one. In the future, if this ever is discussed again, he's going to disclose a potential conflict of interest, even if he doesn't have to, because that's just the best practice. So this was a discussion. There wasn't a motion. He wasn't aware that he even needed to disclose a potential conflict of interest, and so we would ask that this be dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Do we have any questions for the attorney, Commissioner O'Day?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Herman, and Commissioner Topaz, or Councilor Topaz, for being here today. I'm curious, does the city of St. Helens have any private water or sewer districts?
No, the city takes care of both city water and sewer. And we're talking about a system that was put in 1913, and over the years, a number of modifications have been made, basically 2 inches at a time. And the last modification, which has caused this problem, was when the federal government said in the Clear Water Act that you have to have sanitary sewer in a sealed line and stormwater in a separate line. The city of St. Helens did not put the stormwater. The problem of water getting into the area, as the city has grown, it has paved and repaved the streets. So where the water was kept in the streets originally, the water now flows across the sidewalk, through the yards, in houses, down to on the low spot with the sump pumps. So we've built this problem basically 2 inches at a time. The curbs that used to protect us are no longer there. City street levels higher than the curbs. So this is the fix that we have to have. I put in extra sumps outside my building. My building goes to the property line. So I'm actually, my heavy sumps are in the city right away to get rid of the water that comes into this block area coming from streets both on the west side and the east side. If you're going to have to fix the problem, we have to, one, get rid of the water, but we have to raise the curbs to keep the water from coming in. It is a complex problem, and it's not a simple fix.
So thank you, Councilor. I appreciate the explanation. Also, full disclosure, I'm a former city manager, and so I have some context for these issues. I'm assuming that you're looking to use SDC money or some other general fund source of revenue for this project. Was an LID ever explored for it? Because what I'm trying to get at here is Mr. Herman's allegation that there was no financial benefit here, because if you're looking at doing an LID where the property owners pay for the improvement on a proportionate basis, I would tend to agree with you. But if this was going to be an SDC funded or otherwise tax funded project, then it would be to Councilor Topaz's benefit in not having to pay an LID or otherwise directly pay for the improvement.
There's no monies or no requests for any improvement from any funds whatsoever. That's the question is, are we going to do anything? No answer. And that's where it was left.
Thank you.
I'm not, to answer your question, I'm not sure that it did.
Great.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Any other questions for either the investigators or for the attorneys? Seeing none, do we have a motion to, I feel like we're, I think some of us are a little stumped on this.
Mr. Chair, before making a motion, I guess I do have one other question, and it may be one of my standard, potentially standard questions for the investigator. Would you summarize again for us what the focus of additional investigation time and effort would involve?
Well, it could be complicated because it's kind of a messy situation, but it would be to determine if the class exception would apply. And so what I would need to do is determine if, I need to say, did he have an obligation to disclose a potential conflict of interest? In order to decide that, we would need to look at, was he a member of a class? Probably. But would the class exception have applied? Would all members of that neighborhood be affected to the same degree if the city had acted on a proposal to include stormwater collection efforts in the improvement plan?
So, from a non-attorney perspective, mine, the focus of an investigation would revolve around the issue of class.
Of the class exception.
And the class exception.
Right. Would I? Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Fishcomb. Any other comments, questions? Oh, Commissioner Lindsay.
Yeah, I'm toying with this class exception and whether it applies, and it seems to me that it's just a subjective analysis as to whether the class exception applies or not. It seems that there's no real process to an objective process to determine whether it applies or not, except for maybe finding out a few more facts. My gut impression tells me, based on the facts and the evidence we've heard, that there was a class, and so I'm inclined to agree that there was a class, and that therefore the potential conflict of interest announcement was not required. But it seems like we're fishing in the dark here a little bit, trying to figure out what we're going to do. So if we're not sure, and if the process is unsure, and there's no real objective thing, I'm inclined to stop until we figure that out, what that process is. And so I'm inclined to not to proceed for that simple fact alone, is because no one seems to know exactly what the test is for a class, and why should we string this gentleman along when we don't know. So I'm inclined to move to dismiss.
Is that a motion, Commissioner Lindsay?
I'm prepared to make that motion, unless there's any more discussion. Yes, let's do that. I'm moving officially to dismiss. There we go, and then we can continue to have discussion.
We have a motion on the table, and then we'll go to Commissioner O'Day.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair, and all due respect to my fellow commissioner, I'm going to oppose the motion, and I'll set forth my reasons why. So just as a general matter, in local government, whenever a city councilor is voting on a matter that pertains to their own personal property, I think they generally put forward, at a minimum, a potential conflict of interest disclosure, because it's just not known how that action may or may not affect their personal property. I think people do that out of a matter of course, out of an abundance of caution. It's good practice. The question here is whether it was required in these circumstances. And I just don't think we know enough, as Commissioner Lindsay pointed out, to really know. And when we don't know enough, that's an indicator to me that we should proceed to an investigation. In this case, I do think that there are sufficient facts to show that there is a class. The counselor was part of a neighborhood where this project presumably would have been built if the city was willing to address the stormwater problem, as the counselor put forward. The question then is whether the counselor received some sort of disproportionate impact as a result of that public work going into place. And not all property is affected equally by flooding, and it could be that his property would be receive a substantially greater benefit than his neighbors, because he could be the one in the low-lying area. And in fact, city engineers, in looking how to pay for this type of infrastructure, will either use general fund, perhaps they use rate money, perhaps they use system development charges if it's a capacity increasing piece of infrastructure that would meet the qualifications under the SDC statute, or, as my question earlier proposed, they'll propose an LID, which is a local improvement district, where they set a boundary around the properties that would be benefited from the project, and then they assess against those properties a proportionate share of the cost. Because again, it's recognized that not all public works are going to benefit all properties equally. And so I do think in this case it is worthwhile proceeding with an investigation to determine whether, if the stormwater issue was to be addressed, whether the counselor's property would have been disproportionately benefited over the other properties. Because if so, and they were looking or proposing to use, any other funding source than an LID, then I think a potential conflict would have existed here.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm hoping to lean on Commissioner O'Day's experience one last time before he escapes us, and ask him a question, if I might, based on what he just said, which is, I guess what I'm trying to consider is, this was a vote on sort of the general budget, is my understanding, so not on the stormwater project specifically. So this might have been a line item in the budget, but it wasn't a vote on that specific issue. And so I just wanted to confirm that, in your experience, if there's a line item in the budget that might impact a commissioner's personal property, the general practice is that they would declare a potential conflict. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a recurring issue, and one, in fact, that I was hopeful the guide was going to address, and I don't think did, which was explaining my vote on the matter during the last meeting that we had. But nonetheless, I'll let that sleeping dog lie. But yes, when voting on a budget and there's a line item in it that affects that city councilor personally, it often comes up when it's a relative working for the city. In that case, you know, it's a question whether it's an actual or potential. And I do think that there's a little bit of a disagreement in the reading of the statute, because the statute provides that a conflict is one in which it's any decision, action, or recommendation that would result in a pecuniary benefit or avoidance of a pecuniary detriment. And so the fact that the actual conflict of interest statute uses the word recommendation, I've always been of the mind that in such instances, it's actually an actual conflict of interest, even though the likelihood of the decision being acted upon is still uncertain. The fact that it is a recommendation that, if acted on, would be to the counselor's benefit makes it, in my view, an actual conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. Although not everybody looks at the law that way, and some view the actual is only existing where there's truly certainty that the action recommended is going to be acted on. Does that answer your question, Counselor?
Yeah, that's helpful.
Great.
And with that, I'm not letting you leave.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Mr. Herman, we're in discussion on the motion, so we can't go to you. I see your hand up, but just an FYI. Any other discussions on the motion?
Could I just make a clarification in terms of Commissioner Hollister's question? In this case, this wasn't even a line item in the budget. There was no proposal, no motion, no vote. It was simply in the budget committee meeting, he raised this question about whether the city would be looking at the stormwater issue again. The answer was no. So it was more of, in this discussion, of something that, if it happened, would possibly benefit his property. Did he have the obligation to disclose the conflict of interest?
Thank you for that. Commissioner Hollister.
Just thank you, Investigator Myers, for that distinction. I think that's a material distinction from my perspective, and it leads me to the sort of conclusion that I'm going to support Commissioner Lindsay's motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hollister. I will say before I say anything, I'm going to go to Commissioner Edwards. I see her hand up. You're on mute, Commissioner Edwards.
Thank you so much. I undid the hand button instead of the mute. I appreciate the conversation and am inclined to support the dismissal because of the conflict of interest being the issue on the table. I'm curious, though, since it doesn't appear that there was a conflict of interest because no vote or motion was on the floor, why that was the subject that the investigators looked at versus a use of office conversation.
What we did, thank you, Commissioner Edwards, we did look at the use of office. In reviewing the video recording of the meeting, the question was, did he take any action that would be that for his personal benefit that wouldn't be available but for holding his position, that being the test for the 040. And in this case, any member of the public could have posed the question that he asked in that budget committee hearing. In fact, at the next budget committee hearing, a member of the public did come in, pose the question, lead to a big, long discussion. So his neighbors could have come in and asked the exact same question. I don't think asking the question by itself created the use of office. The question is more than, did it create the requirement to disclose that he would be potentially benefited if this question resulted in further action by the budget committee and then the city council?
Thank you for that. And I just wanted to say, I would be inclined to support the motion, despite the expertise of the former city manager here at our table. And frankly, I think that if the investigators dug deep enough and found some potentially technical violation somewhere that took a while, it would probably result in a letter of education, which I think what has taken place here from Commissioner O'Day is so superior on an education point that I don't think that a letter of education would justify what he just got. So I'm inclined to dismiss, and I think all commissioners should support it.
Mr. Chair, let me just add that I'm inclined to support Commissioner O'Day's no vote on the motion because of the lack of information we have on the class issue, as subjective, Commissioner Lindsay, as any analysis might in fact be. We do not have objective standards, as you've said. At the same time, I think Commissioner O'Day has raised a number of good issues in his commentary about the class issue, and that's my first instinct is to thus oppose the motion.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Viscom. Any additional discussion on the motion? Commissioner Edwards.
Yes, I just feel the need to give that caveat that I do support the motion, but I am very persuaded by Commissioner O'Day's arguments, and I do believe that those are best practices, and I do believe that that is absolutely the standard with which we should hold. The only thing that convinces me to vote to support the motion is that there wasn't an actual vote that was being taken on the matter. Otherwise, I would fully support Commissioner O'Day.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Seeing none, a roll call vote, please.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Viscom?
Nay.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye.
Commissioner O'Day?
A respectful nay.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Some contested votes. I think we're due for a 5-minute break. I know we have some people waiting, but we'll
dismiss Mr. Herman.